If you act, you'll either fail and learn or you'll succeed. Either one is productive and useful. If you don't act, nothing happens.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. A few short years ago, Shane Beams returned to Bozeman, Montana from California with a vision for creating a new generation of affordable, commercial, unmanned drones. Using a Kickstarter campaign, Shane founded Vision Aerial in 2013 and is now also the chief engineer of the company. Since Vision Aerial's founding, drones have become popular in many industries, including precision farming, mining, search and rescue, law enforcement, and firefighting. Today on Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, Shane will share the trajectory of his business and trends and issues in the burgeoning drone industry. Shane Beams, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
How are you doing today? Good?
Doing well, yeah.
For our listeners, can we just begin by telling them what Vision Aerial manufactures?
Sure. Vision Aerial is a manufacturer of unmanned aerial systems, which is industry speak for drones.
And when did you decide to get into the drone business? When did you decide drones were your calling?
I like to blame my wife. Several years ago, I was walking through an electronics store and saw a little RC helicopter sitting on the shelf. I think it was like $80 or $100. And I thought, oh, that'd be fun to play with. And decided, I'm not going to waste $80 on a toy that'll break in an hour. And later that week, my wife bought it for me as just a surprise present and gave it to me. And I flew it till it fell apart, which did take slightly more than an hour. But I bought every subsequently larger RC helicopter till I had one of the best, and then thought I could build a better one. So we started tinkering, building a better one. And that ultimately led to a passion in drones.
And you're building commercial drones now, correct?
Correct. Yeah, we got our start, Vision Aerial rather, got to start building high, kind of top shelf recreational drones. But we moved away from that and into commercial infrastructure inspection drones. So we primarily build drones now that are purposed for inspecting bridges and solar fields and crops to a lesser extent.
And what background prepared you for designing and developing this? Because you are the chief engineer of the company as well, right?
I am, yeah. So I'm the lead designer. I do virtually all the design work at the moment. I guess my background is in engineering. So I was trained as a mechanical engineer. But really, it's just been a passion in science since I was a little kid. You know, has anything to do with science or the like has always been fascinating to me, and certainly anything that flew.
And it is sort of a specialized area to design a drone. So how did you learn to design them in particular?
The general category of that design would be called mechatronics now. It's a hybrid between robotics and mechanics. YouTube is a big part of it.
You know, we find that from other guests as well. You can go online and do lots of research and figure out what's going on.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, having training in mechanical engineering and my entire career has been in product development and the production systems around the products that I develop. So I certainly have industry experience in making things. That was a big help. But I think just having a willingness to learn and the willingness to admit that you're ignorant, and I mean that in a complimentary way, knowledge that you don't possess yet. You get on YouTube, you get on the forums, you start engaging with the community and you learn.
So you launched the business in 2013?
Yep.
And how big is it now? How big an operation do you have?
We're still relatively small, although we're in the middle of moving into a new shop now, so that's kind of exciting for us. There's just a few guys involved at the moment, and I'm trying to think of how else you'd measure the size, but...
Sales. I mean, that's another way to look at it.
Yeah, there's been a large uptick recently. The industry's kind of gone through a shift, and we've noticed it real strongly at Vision Aerial. We're now shipping a few drones a month. And given the price points and the high spec level, it's really useful to us. We're definitely moving and shaking now. So,
and you got launched through a Kickstarter campaign, is that correct? Is that how it helped finance what you're doing?
Yeah, so the Kickstarter campaign provided two major points of interest. One was obviously the capital and the orders. But the other one was a proof that what we were making was something that people actually wanted. When we got started, my wife and I were actually traveling around the country in an RV looking for where we wanted to live. And this was kind of the point where I was transitioning from flying RC helicopters rather tinkering with these prototypes. And we spent about a year in the RV traveling around the country. And as we went from RV spot to RV spot, we were playing with this prototype, or I was rather. And people kept asking me where they could buy one. And so when you're jobless in an RV driving around the country and people ask where they can buy your prototype, you start concluding, well, maybe I should consider selling these things. So when we got, after that long trip, we concluded that Bozeman's where we wanted to live. So we moved back to Bozeman and I gave it a go by developing a more production ready unit. It wasn't just the wood prototype I carved out by hand in my RV. And then I had just enough capital to build one prototype and get it on Kickstarter and show the world that, hey, this is what I want to make. Do you guys want it?
And now you have orders domestically and internationally for your product?
Yeah. So the company is almost kind of broken into two categories. You know, for the first couple of years, we made what we called the Switchblade Pro was our main drone. And it was a top shelf recreational drone.
Which would sell for how much?
The price point on the Pro was about $2,000 per unit. So it was kind of an elite group of, we really like drones for fun or maybe low-level commercial use like real estate and that sort of thing. But once Asia started getting better at manufacturing drones and they were more reliable, we didn't want to compete on price. So we pivoted the company then to the commercial infrastructure markets. So there was about a 12, 18-month window where all of the products got redesigned from scratch. And we just essentially July, August this year is when we've hit the ground with all those new products in an aggressive way. And that's, so there's been kind of this gap in the company for sales. But now that the products are out and they've been vetted, we're selling them very well. And prior to that, we sold our Switchblade Pro all over the world. It was in, I think it was in 4 continents and 15 countries. We have Switchblade Pros flying.
Wow.
So that was definitely exciting.
The commercial iteration of your product, is that registered and licensed by like the FAA?
The FAA, which is the Federal Aviation Administration, is the governmental body responsible for regulating all the airways. And they and the NTSB, the National Traffic Highway Safety Board, are the ones responsible for keeping us safe when we're in the sky. The FAA gets a lot of flack for being slow and onerous regulation-wise, but our experience with them has been to the contrary. They're clearly well-intentioned people trying to integrate this new technology that is potentially a threat to manned aviation. And for a time there, they did require drone registration, and any drone over 55 pounds had to get certified by the FAA. But since we're under that weight category, we didn't have to do the certification process, and the drone registration has since been ruled, I think it was ruled unconstitutional, so it's gone away now.
Well, it's a threat because of, well, for example, recently I think there was a Canadian airliner that got hit by a drone.
Allegedly, yeah.
Yes, allegedly. But what are the other threats that would come into play?
There's two major ones. And I should make it clear, I'm a manned pilot as well. I'm a private pilot in the general aviation community, and I don't want to see a drone on short final any more than anyone else. So most of the people in the industry are very clearly aligned. We all want the same thing. We want safe skies. We want privacy to be established. There are very few people that have malice intent in the industry. The vast majority of the problems are coming from recreational users that don't really necessarily even know the rules, or if they do, they just don't really care. So we want to be careful that we design the regulation in a way that regulates the problem and not the entire industry. We should focus on the difficult sections. And that's fortunately where the FAA is focusing now. So they, from my experience at least, they're pretty reasonable people trying to do our society well.
Sure. And what are the applications of your particular drones commercially? I mean, where do you see them being used now and where else will they be used in the future?
Well, the industry is just now starting to explode. So, I mean, it's taking off now in a way that I think people didn't realize. And it's like any technology. When we first created cell phones, people didn't expect apps to be the dominant thing we use them for.
Well, you didn't expect to be able to buy pizzas and go to the movies using your phone.
Sure. And so some people are, you know, on the more progressive fronts, they're looking at, well, can we deliver a pizza by a drone and those sorts of things. Drone delivery is a hot topic. But I think that there's a lot more uses than our imaginations can currently see right now. So things like I saw a research video the other day that was showing a series of drones carrying cables across a span and weaving them like a rope to make a rope bridge. So for first responders trying to get across, say, a gully, the drones could go out and fly and create a rope bridge without having to traverse the canyon. Then the first responders could get across. So it's things like that that I think open up our imagination and start letting us think in a different way. Our drones are primarily used to carry sensor payloads. So we carry radar, LIDAR cameras, thermal cameras, and we're looking at things like bridge deck inspections. Like right now, if you look just for one example, if you look at how a bridge is currently inspected with conventional methods, they use a truck called a snooper truck. That's essentially like a bucket truck you'd see on a power line, right, except the bucket goes around the bridge so they can be underneath it. You take a lane, you take a bridge, you block a lane of traffic. You have two or three operators, one of which has his life at risk, you know, and granted they do everything they can to keep it safe, but nonetheless, you're hanging on a bucket under a bridge. Then they drive this $800,000 asset around while a guy with his eyeballs looks at the bridge for problems. A drone can do that for a tiny fraction of the price without putting a man's life at risk. And then more importantly, it's not displacing the job of the inspector. It's a force multiplier, because now that snooper truck can be used to repair other bridges, because drones can't yet repair the bridge. They can only inspect it at the moment.
Right.
So if we can use one inspection team to go inspect a dozen bridges and one snooper truck to go repair bridges, that's a more effective use of the resource.
Well, it also, it seems to me from what I've seen, can be used in ways that would put less human life at risk, for example, power towers and looking at inspections there, and search and rescue, you know, fire inspection and you know, fire season. I'm sure there were drones being used.
Absolutely. So the one of the adages we kind of like, search and rescue is one of my favorite applications. And the adage I always say is I want to take the search out of search and rescue. It's same thing. You look at, you have a set of resources, and in some, you know, you have a hiker lost in the woods. The vast majority of those resources are being utilized to try to locate the hiker. Once the hiker's found, rescuing is relatively easy. Well, if you have a small fleet of drones go out with thermal cameras, you can find them much more quickly and more thoroughly, and at a lower cost of resources. Now you can have the one search and rescue team that might have been 20 people can now be 10 search and rescue teams. That's just a much more effective use of resource.
So the drones are being used in both the B2B, business-to-business space, but there's also many applications in the consumer area, like, you know, the talk that Amazon will be delivering to your home using drones.
Yeah.
Is that real? And if it's real, how soon will that be happening? How soon can people expect that?
It's definitely real. Amazon gets most of the press because they have a brilliant marketing team, and they have a very clever drone as well. But they're not the only one in the player. DHL, even Domino's for a little while was, I don't know how serious Domino's was actually at it, but there's a number of delivery companies. I know UPS has been looking into it as well. And most of them are looking at it in the, not so much Amazon, but the delivery companies are looking at it in the same light as a force multiplier. So you have one truck go to a neighborhood, drone delivers lightweight packages in the neighborhood while the driver delivers the heavy packages. You make one driver more effective. And in the case of Amazon, predicting when it will happen is difficult. Technologically, most of the hurdles are already met. There's a couple of small hurdles that need to be sorted technologically, but the big hurdles are logistics and legal. So you have to integrate those drones with the national airspace, and you have to make sure that they're safe. And so there's a legal application.
Well, there's also people have some concern about it flying over private property and what happens in, you know, the airspace over restricted areas if you're going to, make deliveries or to, you know, reach your final destination.
Absolutely. And so right now the rules for the FAA are called the Part 107 rules, and it's a Part 107 to the Federal Aviation Regulations, or the FARs, as people refer to them. And the 107 rules are required for any commercial operation. So for example, I'm a 107 pilot, and that allows me to fly for hire. One of the legal hurdles that Amazon faces is that they don't have pilots. These are entirely, you know, most drones are actually remotely piloted aircraft. When they're in a air quote drone function, that's an autonomous function. So if you're flying a pre-programmed mission, for example, where I tell the drone to go to a dozen waypoints and come home, while it's flying those waypoints, it's a drone. When I'm flying it, it's a remotely piloted aircraft. And so the way the 107 rules work is there's a number of restrictions. The drone can't be out of my line of sight. I have to fly in the daytime, and a few other things. So the Amazon has to get past that hurdle legally. And then more importantly, they have to get past the safety and privacy issues. And the good news for Amazon is that you don't own the airspace above your land. There's no such thing as private airspace unless even in a private airstrip, the FAA manages the national airspace from the surface to about 60,000 feet, which is a good thing because you don't want to have inconsistent rules when you fly over one guy's house, you know.
There are people who are afraid of drones. They're afraid of, maybe having an accident caused by a drone. They're afraid of multiple drones being in the air and causing confusion. They don't like the concept of a drone, you know, coming to your home, you know, invading your privacy. Are those fears well-founded in your opinion?
If you have a fear, it's obviously important to you. So right. It's, and also I share some of those fears. I think I don't want to have a drone hovering outside my window, looking at my window. That's creepy. I mean, who wants that? Nobody, you know? The safety issues are going down. Drones are safer now than they've ever been. And they did get kind of a bad name at the beginning because the technology in the beginning was very unreliable. And we, you know, we've moved past that hurdle. And I never really worry about a drone having an in-flight issue. That's not really such a concern. But the privacy issues or the fear issues, they are a concern because even if they aren't founded on reality, it doesn't need to be. If you're afraid of it, it's going to affect the legislation. It's going to affect the public perception. And we need to make sure, as people in the industry, need to make sure that we have mitigating factors for that. And I think that's just how you're wise with it. So a lot of it is just good piloting behavior. And the vast majority of those instances with privacy concerns are usually recreational pilots. So one of the concerns we had when we had initial discussions with the FAA about how to structure the 107 rules was simply that the level of restriction you can apply is directly related to your ability to enforce it. And the FAA has virtually no ability to enforce these regulations. So it's all kind of on a, you know, best practice right now. So our request was, let's make them very obvious, very reasonable rules until the level of enforcement's at a place where we can then make them a little more restrictive. Otherwise, people would just disregard the law.
Sure. And that sort of bleeds into one of the other permutation, which would be, for example, terrorist risk of somebody using a drone, and there'd be no way to, control that.
You know, in the beginning, I avoided the use of the word drone like the plague, because it's such an ominous word. You know, you think of Terminator and Skynet and all these terrible things. And yeah, absolutely. A drone can be used to do harm, just like a car can be used to do harm. You know, it's a tool, and it's a new technology, and how a society adapts that new technology is a reflection of us. And so we do have legitimate threats. You know, if somebody wants to do some harm with a drone, they probably can. Right. And there's an industry called counter UAS or counter drone, and they're developing technologies to protect environments, largely airport airspaces, so that if you did have a bad actor come into, say, LaGuardia, you want a means of removing that threat from the airspace, because it's, aside from the safety factor, it's hugely expensive. If there's an unidentified aircraft in a Class Bravo airport, the cost per minute is paramount while all those planes circle. So just from a practical standpoint, we need counter UAS tech.
There's also another variant, which is military application. Mm-hmm. There was a 60 Minutes segment recently talking about drone swarms, you know, using drones with visual recognition, you know, capabilities to, you know, for military applications. And that sometimes, is brought up as an issue that to be of concern. Is that for you an issue of concern?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of torn because there's something about a swarm of drones that's kind of ominous. But it's also fascinating. I mean, if I see a huge flock of finch moving around in a swarm fashion, I'm also fascinated by it. So that's, the engineer in me is fascinated by it. And then, you know, the citizen in me is concerned. But I think one thing that's important to remember is that military drones do not make kill decisions. And the vast majority of military drones aren't even drones. They're remotely piloted. So, if you're flying a Predator drone for a Reaper drone, for example, there's a pilot behind the controls of those. So there's a human making the decisions. And the only time it's arguably a drone is when it hits what they call bingo time and goes back to the airport. Its route back is sometimes autonomous. But even when it gets back to the airfield, another operator takes it over and lands it. So it's important to remember that if we have a swarm of drones, they don't have programming to go out and choose to do harm or choose not to do harm. That's still always down to a human. And I think it's like any technology. New technologies cause fear and they cause excitement. And the direction we choose to take it is based on public perception and how we want to use it.
Let me switch for a minute to the business side. You're in a fast-growing industry that's changing almost daily. What have you learned that was unexpected as a businessman running a business?
It's kind of hard to quantify into pieces to talk about, but I mean, as an engineer, I've always, for the vast majority of my career, has been developing products for other people. And part of the reason why I decided to do the drone tech is that I figure I'm designing products for other people. Why not design one for myself? So the business side has been a learning curve, but it's definitely been an exciting one. I'd say that the difficulty on the business development side is focused real heavily on how do you promote, how do you sell.
And, you know, running a business is, regardless of what the product is, you have to sell your product, you have
exactly
to market it, you have to run your operation as a smart business would.
For me, I'm a bit of a pragmatist, and I kind of prefer the 1920s marketing model that is, you know, Johnson's Motor Oil is better than Smith's Motor Oil. Come buy it, because it's better. there's a quantifiable, evidence-based reason for buying Johnson's motor oil instead of Smith's motor oil. Whereas that's not really the world we live in now. You know, the world we live in now is post-psychological influence in marketing, where perception is more important than quantifiable benefits. And that's one of the reasons why I really like shift to the commercial applications, is that the sales pitch is relatively easy. You have an $800,000 asset that takes four people. Now you can have a $20,000 asset that takes one person, and it's more effective and it provides better data. You know, that's a very engineering way to pitch a product, but it's also a very effective way. And it helps me move away from the ours is sleeker, sexier looking, or we'll get you more this or that. It's more, there's an ROI. That's why our product's worth it.
And how competitive is your space in the industry?
Well, in the beginning, we actually got in. One of the reasons why we pivoted to this space was because there was very little competition. At the time we pivoted, there was essentially drones up to about a couple thousand, $2,000-$3,000 in the recreational category, and very light commercial use, like real estate photography, that sort of thing. And then there was the defense contractor and up. So you had this $0 to $3,000 range, and then you had a $80 to $10 million range. And there was very little between $3,000 and $80,000. And so we thought, well, why don't we make a $10,000 drone that competes with the $80,000 drones? And I think it was a good decision. It's worked very well for us. Other people have come to that conclusion as well now. So over the last couple of years, we've seen some competitors come into the space. But it's relatively open. And one of the things we have going for us is we are almost entirely American-made. They're designed, built, and assembled here in Bozeman. And most of our parts even come from local sources, which has been very attractive to some government agencies and to the military.
So what are your plans for the future? Where do you see yourself a year or two down the road?
Yeah, that's kind of why we named it Vision Aerial, is to try to make sure that the vision is always forward-thinking. So I don't know that I'm always doing that, but one of the fantasies I kind of have daily about the business is that I'm driving down the road and I see a switchblade inspecting a power line, or I'm driving over a bridge and I see one of our Vector hexacopters inspecting the bridge. The idea that we're keeping people safe and we're making tax dollars more efficiently spent, and we get to build flying robots. It's just a fun job. I'd like to just see that grow into a space where it's commonplace.
Sure. Based on your experience to date, what advice do you have to another person like yourself, a young technology engineering-oriented person who wants to start a business and has all of the passion for the product but really hasn't run the business end of it? What kind of advice do you have?
Well, that's definitely where I was. I'm definitely a passionate person when it comes to engineering and science, but the business acumen was something that was learned as you go. I think the best piece of advice would just be do more, think less. Because I have a number of friends, and myself included in this category. As an engineer, I think, this is a high-risk thing. I'm going to quit my day job that pays my bills to go try to start a company. It's scary. And so you want to mitigate that fear by creating a very detailed, executable plan that just can't go wrong. But there's two problems with that. Is one, that plan can't exist. You'll never be perfect. And the moment it's perfect, the industry's changed and it's no longer perfect. So it's in my experience, it's been much better to act and then let yourself fail and learn. Because if you act, you'll either fail and learn or you'll succeed. Either one is productive and useful. If you don't act, nothing happens. And then you just constantly live in obscurity saying, I wish I could have. Just do it. Just take the risk, take the leap. And worst case scenario is you'll lose some money and you'll learn some lessons, and then you'll be wiser for it.
On that note, Shane Beams, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing with us your vision for Vision Aerial and the fascinating, wonderful world of drones and where they're going as an industry and the role that you play in that industry.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It was my pleasure. Good luck.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please reach out to us at mtpr.org. There you can also find all the contact information from previous guests and content from previous shows. Until the next episode, this is Arnie Sherman wishing you good health and success. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.